In the year 586 BCE, the whole world fell apart for the southern kingdom, Judah. The northern kingdom had already fallen to the hands of the Babylonians, and the Babylonians were now conquering the southern kingdom, leveling Jerusalem, tearing down the temple, and taking the people who had lived there and carrying them off into exile. So not only did they not have their holy city, not only did they not have their temple, the one place in the whole world where they could worship. Can you imagine having just one place in the world where you could appropriately worship God and to have that destroyed? But they were taken off into a country where they were essentially exiles and refugees. They were among people who spoke a different language, who practiced a different religion, a people who looked down on them because of who they were and where they had come from. And after a while, the Babylonians lost to the Persians. And the Persians took a very different approach to dealing with exiles and refugees. They decided they would allow at least some of them to return to their holy city, to return to Jerusalem, to rebuild the walls, to begin to rebuild the temple under the leadership of Ezra and Nehemiah. And it's that period of coming back home and rebuilding that many scholars believe this psalm came from. I mean, listen to the words of it. You heard them sung. Let me read it to you again. When the Lord restored the fortunes of Zion, we were like those who dream. It was a dream come true. When they were in exile, it was hard for them to even imagine coming back. It was literally a dream come true. Then our mouth was filled with laughter and our tongue with shouts of joy. Then it was said among the nations, all the other people other than Israel, the Lord has done great things for them. The Lord has done great things for us, and we rejoiced. Restore our fortunes, O Lord, like the watercourses of the Negev. A group of us just traveled through Israel, and much of it is an arid desert landscape. And in those landscapes, water is essential. To have the water courses of the Negev, to know where to find water, how to stay close to water, was essential to staying alive. Just like God's work among the people, like the water courses of the Negev. May those who sow in tears reap with shouts of joy. Those who go out weeping, bearing the seed for sowing, shall come home with shouts of joy, carrying their sheaves. It indicates that not only were they rebuilding the walls of the temple, or the temple and the walls of the city, they were actually planting crops. They were growing crops, which is a sign that there is hope for the future. The people had found that in their brokenness, God had taken their shattered lives and God was working to help put them back together again, using the Persians of all people. Can you imagine? I guess that means God can use anybody. But they were planting and they were looking forward to that time when they would be bringing the sheaves of grain back in, singing songs of joy. That the days of weeping had turned into days of rejoicing, and those tears of grief had been transformed into tears of joy. That's what God specializes in doing. Story after story after story from both the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament testify to the fact that God is at work in the world trying to put back together broken lives, trying to put back together shattered cultures and worlds. But that didn't stop with the New Testament. It continues to this day. It was the fall of 1973. I was driving up the Dan Ryan Expressway right in the middle of Chicago. Now, this was a young man who had never, ever driven in a town larger than Nashville. And Nashville was a lot smaller then than it is now. And I had not driven here that much, even though I went to school here. I didn't have a car when I went to school here. So I'm driving through the middle of Chicago on the Dan Ryan Expressway, and quite frankly, if I could have found a way to get off and turn around and go back home, I would have done it. But I only knew how to get to one place, and that was the seminary I was supposed to attend. And so I followed those directions, and I pulled into the parking there at the seminary at Garrett at Northwestern. And I went into the housing office. I got the keys to my apartment. It was a little one-room efficiency. I was going to take my few belongings from the car up to the efficiency. I was climbing the back steps, and I ran into some folks who are already students there, Lee and Charlene Kammerer. Now, they had been students there for a year or maybe more at that point. I can't remember exactly, but they knew the lay of the land. They welcomed me. They were willing to kind of show me around, teach me the ropes, and they became very, very, very close friends. It wasn't long, and it didn't take long to know Charlene Kammerer to realize that this was the kind of individual that you would love to have for your pastor, you would love to have for your district superintendent, you would love to have for your bishop. I feel the same way about our current district superintendent, Harriet Bryan. I've known her for a number of years, too. Same kind of leadership qualities. Now, we were all young. We were in our 20s, right? What did we know about district superintendents and bishops? We weren't even ordained. And so, the next year, she applied for ordination in the Florida Conference. And they didn't know what to do with a woman who was applying for ordination. And they deferred her. Her home conference, this very gifted person in her home conference was said, sorry, we don't know what to do with you. She came back to Garrett, took another degree, actually. She got her Master of Divinity and a Master of Religious Education degree while she was there. Even though I was a year or two behind her in seminary, I was ordained a probationary member of the conference before she was. Why? Because I was male and because she was female. And quite frankly, we had been ordaining women for about 20 years at that time, supposedly, just not everywhere. Finally, she was ordained a probationary member and then a full elder. But she didn't go back to Florida to serve because they didn't know what to do with her. They didn't have a place for her. She went to be the interim dean of the chapel at Duke University. But then finally there was a place for Charlene, and she went back and she began to serve in her home conference. And over the years, she became the first woman to serve as a head of staff in a large membership church in the Florida Conference. She became the first woman to be a district superintendent in the Florida Conference, and the first woman to be elected bishop in the southeastern jurisdiction of the United Methodist Church. After having been deferred because they didn't know what to do with a woman in ministry. You see, that's how God works. That brokenness that she felt when her home conference did not want her, didn't know what to do with her, was finally repaired. And it wasn't an easy journey, obviously. I'll be quite honest with you. I can't think of anything worse than being a district superintendent or a bishop. I'm serious. District superintendents are that middle management that have a great deal of responsibility and very little authority. And with bishops, oh my goodness, you're dealing with people's lives all the time, and you spend a fair amount of your time dealing with lawsuits. Sounds like fun, doesn't it? And yet, a few years ago, I was teaching in the Virginia Annual Conference when Charlene was serving as bishop there. And we had a chance to catch up. Late one night, we visited for several hours. And I said, how is this being a bishop? I can't think of anything worse. And she told me that she had found a kind of freedom in that role, a freedom that she had not known as a woman in ministry up to that point. I mean, clearly, I'm glad that there are people like that whom God can use in those kinds of leadership roles. You see, even more light shines through those broken places. when God has come and put our lives back together. It's a different kind of light, and it doesn't mean that the scars don't show. But even more light shines through. In the early 1960s, it felt for a lot of folks like the whole world was breaking apart. That hierarchy that I had been born into of white males, white females, people of color, was beginning to be challenged. That phrase, all men are created equal, was beginning to be questioned to see if that indeed included women being created equal, if that included men and women of color being created equal. And there were folks who were willing to stand up and say, we're not seeing it, and demanding that we live up to our highest ideals. That era we tend to call the civil rights movement. I remember it. I was young, but I saw on television what happened to those who stood in peaceful demonstration against that hierarchy that we had kept in place and we who were at the top felt really comfortable with. During that time, there was a young man who had been born in Pennsylvania, grew up in Ohio, went to a Methodist school in Ohio, was a conscientious objector during the Korean War. After the Korean War, after he was released from prison for being a conscientious objector, he was a Methodist missionary for a while, various parts of the world. Then he decided he wanted to go to seminary. So he came to Vanderbilt. His name was James Lawson. James Lawson came to Vanderbilt only a short time after they began allowing people of color to be admitted. James Lawson was and is African American. He had been influenced by the teachings of Jesus to such an extent that he was firmly committed to nonviolence. This is why he was a conscientious objector. He had read that story of Jesus and heard it so many times, and it had gotten into him so deeply that he knew that when the Roman Empire did the very worst that they possibly could think to do to a human being, when they took him into custody, when they scourged him, when they tortured him to death, Jesus did not return evil for evil. He did not return violence for violence. And James Lawson wanted to do that and teach other people how to do that. Now, many will tell you he was influenced by Mohandas Gandhi, and he was. And Gandhi was influenced by Jesus as well. But before James Lawson ever heard the name Mohandas Gandhi, he had heard the name of Jesus. And he knew that those ideas went back to him. Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King asked him to come to the South. He said, we need someone like you here. So using Methodist churches in the area, African-American Methodist churches, and the Vanderbilt Divinity School, he began to teach people how to respond nonviolently when they were acted upon with violence. Because you see, downtown, African-American people could not sit at the counters in the stores. It was illegal. It was against the law. When they decided that that did not fall under all men being created equal, they decided they would simply go and exercise their right to sit. And when they did, there were people who thought that simple demonstration was too much. They were troublemakers. They were called things even worse. And so James Lawson trained these young people when they were called ugly names, and you know the name I'm talking about, and it's come back into popularity for some reason, and I cannot for the life of me imagine why. That kind of language is not political correctness, okay? And it's not about political correctness. What I was taught it is that it's about politeness and basic human decency. But they were called ugly names. And people would take cigarettes and put their cigarettes out on the back of their necks and on their arms and hands. And they were learning how to sit there and let that happen and not respond with violence. They would be spat upon. They would be hit. But because they were followers of Jesus, and James Lawson had taught them the techniques of how you sit there and take it, instead of responding in kind, they were able to do that. I saw, and some of you saw on television later, where those demonstrators had fire hoses turned on them, or dogs turned on them, or they were beaten with billy clubs. For some of us today, those were the good old days. We need to rough them up, don't we? Huh? Just like we used to do, right? No, nothing about that is Christian. Nothing about that is Christian. Nothing about that has any semblance of common human decency either. But James Lawson was able to teach people how to live out the message of Jesus even when they were being hated and under attack. Isn't it interesting that so many of us as Christians have forgotten that Jesus said, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who persecute you? When did we write that out of the Bible? Those are in red letters, folks. It's what Jesus said. It's our job description. And yet we've thrown it out the window for some kind of quest for political power or racial supremacy or something. For his efforts, James Lawson was expelled from Vanderbilt Divinity School. Most of you all know that, don't you? A number of the faculty resigned as a result of that. He went on, he finished his work, he became a very prominent pastor. And within the past decade, Vanderbilt Divinity School and Vanderbilt University have both apologized for that, for expelling him. He's been invited to come and teach. And I don't know, if it had been me, I think I would have taken great satisfaction in saying thanks but no thanks. But you see, fortunately, James Lawson understudied Jesus. And he said, of course I'll come and teach. Of course I'll accept your apology. Of course, I will come and I will teach the very same thing I've been teaching for all these decades, and that is how to live like Jesus. God took that rejection, that brokenness for having done the right thing when it was unpopular, when you came under attack for that, and God put that life back together in a way that so much light has shone through the life of James Lawson. And continues to shine through that life. Because you see, that's what God specializes in doing. It doesn't matter how you've been broken, how your life has fallen apart, or the world around you has fallen apart. God is about healing those divisions, not creating divisions. God is about healing brokenness, not breaking people. God is about welcoming the other, not hating the other. I'm not sure where we ever got that idea that that was okay. Certainly for Christians, it is not okay. And yet, if we cooperate with the power of God, amazing things can happen through our broken lives. Will the scars still show? Of course they will. You look closely enough at this, you can still see them. But you know what? That's where that extra light shines through. That's what allows other people who have been broken to identify. Other people who have been rejected. Other people who have gone through some kind of life-shattering experience to say, that person must know what I felt, at least a little of it. That's what we're called to do. That's how we cooperate with God. Because you see, God is in the business of putting broken lives back together. And it's our choice. Do we break other lives? Do we push others away? Or do we become a part of that great dream that God dreamed all the way back in the 6th century BCE of bringing people home, of bringing them together? Can tears of grief actually turn into tears of joy? You bet. That's what our God specializes in. We're just invited to join in.